Hey, it's Kyle Meredith, host of the Kyle Meredith With podcast, presented by WFPK at WFPK.org and the Consequence Podcast Network. It's a series that puts the spotlight on iconic musicians and actors, inviting them to drop by and talk about their latest projects, whether it's albums, TV shows, films, or beyond.
I'm going to say something I don't want to say. Here it goes. Without Spinal Tap, there is no Tenacious D.
Whoa. Man.
We get great stories and the biggest scoops from people like Garbage's Shirley Manson, the 1975's Matty Healy, Jack Black and Kyle Gass of Tenacious D, Maya Hawke, Kiefer Sutherland, and everyone in between. New episodes arrive every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, so it's a great way to keep up with your favorite artists and discover some new ones. You can find Kyle Meredith With on the Consequence Podcast Network or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey pod people, Engineer Adam here, jumping in for a quick second to let you know about the brand new all-in-one platform for all of you creative podcasters out there. Anchor makes it easier than ever to make a podcast. It's free to use and has all the creation tools you need to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or computer. Plus, Anchor will get your podcast set up on Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, wherever podcasts are found. Even better, Anchor helps you connect with sponsors, even if you're just starting out. It's the perfect choice for podcasters, so make sure to check it out. Download the free Anchor app or go to anchor.fm to get started. That's anchor.fm. Back to the show.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Pod people, Leo Phillips here with This Must Be The Gig, your little backstage pass to the world of live music. Every single week we bring you fascinating conversations from the beating heart of the performance scene with some of the most exciting names on this big, gigantic, spongy globe. We talk passion, we talk first concerts, insights into the creative mind during this truly unusual time, and everything in the juicy center.
This week, we're excited to share a conversation with Fergal Lawler and Noel Hogan, the drummer and guitarist of the Cranberries.
It's just one of those ones that kind of
we kind of forgot about it.
I forgot about the same thing.
The group formed in 1989 in Limerick, Ireland, along with Noel's brother Mike on bass, and later joined by vocalist Dolores O'Riordan. Over the course of 8 albums and 20 years, the group wrote some of the biggest, most memorable sing-along anthems of the 90s, from Linger to Dreams to Zombie to Salvation, becoming a worldwide phenomenon. Tragically, the group's most recent record, 2019's In the End, turned out to be their final one, as Dolores sadly passed away prior to its completion. But now, Fergal and the Hogan brothers are honoring their late friend and continuing the strength of their legacy with a 25th anniversary reissue of the Cranberries' second album, No Need to Argue. In addition to the original album, the package will include B-sides, demos, live recordings, a slew of unreleased photos, an essay from the band's archivist, and more. In this chat, Lior spoke with Fergal and Noel about looking back at No Need to Argue at 25 years, the beloved song Yesterday Is Gone making the cut after only previously appearing on MTV Unplugged, seeing Irish heroes U2 as teens, the power of a good cover, and so much more. So let us not be delayed. This is Lior and the Cranberries. Enjoy!
Did you know at the beginning of the pandemic when you were going to release?
No. We actually, it had been penciled in to kind of release it a bit sooner. Mm-hmm. But then the pandemic happened and it got pushed back to September, and now it's after getting pushed back till November.
Oh my gosh. So wait, how does that feel in terms of plans? Because obviously you both have been in this for so long and touring, and it's often very sorted and planned out, and then this year arrived. So what did you have, like what was your preconceived idea of the year prior to what happened? What were you expecting to do?
Well, it was the main thing was the release of this No Need to Argue box set, and I suppose we might have travelled to maybe around Europe and done some press and interviews and stuff for that. You know, we weren't sure really, but we were open to that. But obviously now it seems to be just all phoners and Zoom and Skype.
Thanks for putting Skype in there.
Yeah, I was going to say that. Yeah.
Shout out Skype. I hope we get sponsored by Skype. Seriously.
Yeah, get some money back here.
But wait, this might sound like a very loaded question, I suppose, but I know at least for me, like my system was prepped to, because I go to a lot of festivals and that's my work and things like that. So my system was kind of, my body was ready to go, like the physicality side of it. I know that obviously being in isolation isn't new for an artist necessarily, or at least focusing on one project or, you know, being in a studio, four walls and stuff like that. But how has that felt like for each of your own creativity? Like, have you felt kind of just mad and bonkers at times, or have you felt pretty like creative?
It's been mixed, I think. Like initially I thought, okay, going to get loads done now because I'm going to be home for months on end. But found that I was distracted a lot because we have kids and they were off school, and you started to do a lot of kind of stuff around the house that you probably wouldn't normally be doing, like DIY things and that. We were quite lucky here in Ireland. The weather was so good during our lockdown in the first couple of months. So it didn't really entice you to kind of be locked in a room and, kind of working, if you want to call it that. But I do find in the past kind of month or two that kind of process is becoming easier to do, and kind of you figure, right, now we kind of get back to some kind of normality here and try and write stuff and just create again. And like, it's probably, I'd say, one of the longest runs of being at home that we've ever had, like since we were, since we started this. Because even on years off, you'd be going away on holidays, you'd be doing different things, and you'd never be at home this long. So it's been good and bad, I would think of it. It's been predominantly good. It's been great to spend so much time with the family for a change. But I think the creative side of it was slow to take off. But I guess maybe it's a case of just we're all getting used to this now, and we realize this is the way it is for the time being.
I appreciate like how honest you are, but I also think like for those who are going to be listening, I don't think they realize what kind of extensive schedule an artist, and a band like yours has had for so many years. So it's almost like, for predominantly most of your life, you've been on the road. And as you said, even on the downtime, you're either creating more or you're spending it with loved ones. So it wraps the wires in my brain to just think how long it's been and how we were all so optimistic back in March. Like people, people were like, oh, I'll see you September, And it's okay, we're here. Like nothing's changed.
No. Oh. Exactly. And there's no end in sight. I mean, it's not like, we go, come January, we're all going to be back out again. And, it's still, we've all been in this holding pattern, I guess, for 6 months now and quite possibly another 6 months or more.
So what do you miss the most then? What is the thing like about touring and creating and that kind of treadmill that you are on? What do you miss the most about it?
I suppose the fact that we were in lockdown, not being able to travel is the worst, even on the time off, I'd like to travel and get some sun, go to a beach somewhere. So I kind of miss that. The not being able to travel part is very, very hard. I mean, we could travel, I think once the lockdown lifted, we could travel to certain places, but it would have meant spending fucking 6 hours or something in an airport.
Yeah.
You're on a plane for a few hours and you don't know who's going to be sitting behind you, coughing into your face or, it's a bit risky. So we kind of, I think a lot of people in Ireland stayed at home. I really miss gigs as well, going to see bands live.
Yes.
Watching on TV, no matter how good your sound system is or whatever, it isn't the same because there's no movement of air in a room, people, the energy and all that. Gigs are an incredible thing, and it's an awful shame that we
can't seem to organise it safely.
Do you remember the concert that you saw before coronavirus? Like, what was the last one you saw?
I think I went to see Bjork in Dublin.
What? That's not
one,
a bad way to go, right? Can you?
Oh, I know.
Like,
yeah.
Having that as your last one.
Incredible.
Like, that's amazing. Wow. There's nothing like seeing her live. I feel like every time I've seen her, it's been just, it's like watching, it's theatre. It's watching.
It is. Completely. It's like opera.
It's like exactly like opera. There's something so unusual and unfamiliar, and yet your brain is just completely entranced. Yeah, she's something else, that's for sure. And I love that she doesn't allow photographers either. She only has one photographer.
She's right. There's nothing worse than being at a concert and everyone has their phone up. Because I don't want to watch it through a phone. I want to actually watch what's on the stage. You know?
I know.
It's ridiculous.
But I mean, I feel like there's always going to be some sort of thing that is distracting, whether it's like somebody talking. You know, it's like humans. People need to like release that excitement in some way. And I feel like those, but it's different. I don't know. You've obviously noticed, you've toured the world. Like, you've obviously noticed each country is completely different. Like, the cultures are so different. Some cultures are like dead quiet. Others are like, I don't give a fuck that you're on stage. Like, you can be whoever you are. I don't care how famous you are. I don't care. I want to drink my beer. And others are like just, you know, trying to get onto the stage. They're so close. What do you feel like you have a favorite memory of a favorite tour? I know that's such a broad question to ask, but maybe just if there was a crowd that felt particularly special or a country that you hadn't expected to go to.
It's more town to town.
Yeah.
Yes,
rather
exactly.
than, you know, a particular country. Because you could play the same venue two nights in a row and have a completely different gig, depending on your mood, depending on the crowd. You know, sometimes it really clicks and everything goes really well and it, you know, it all works perfectly. Then other nights it's kind of you're feeling a bit off or whatever. But
do you know when you're off though? Like, do you feel that offness like from the crowd or from each other before you get on the stage?
Yeah, definitely.
No, it's not when you get on.
No.
Or not before you get on. It's actually when you're playing.
Afterwards.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
You
Tell
can
me more.
Feel it.
I want to know more.
We're like, it's like a telepathy thing, you know, when the four of us play in a room. Anytime the four of us will play together, it's just something you can almost sense what's going to happen next. You know, when you're trying out new ideas or whatever, you just seem to flow. I don't know. It's strange. It's hard to explain it.
Because I think it's fascinating, I have to say, because I'm not that I want to bottle up that feeling of failure by any means, but I feel like it's fascinating because there's so many different modes as a performer where one thing can set somebody off. You know, if a beat is behind, can set another person off. If you are improvising, that can actually make it better. So I feel like there's so many different approaches, just like any career, I suppose, but especially with performance because it's so volatile. And it's so, you know, you cannot edit a live performance, essentially. You know, whatever's happened must happen. So if you're feeling that weirdness, like something's just off, what do you do? Do you do something to get out of it or you just go with it?
Yeah, like you kind of have to go with it. I mean, that feeling that we get, if you go, I'm having a kind of crappy gig, you're just not feeling it. That may not necessarily be the way the crowd look at it. They could be looking at this and going, this is the greatest thing I've ever seen in my life, you know? And great, if that's what's happening, perfect. So you still got to, you know, you got to do, if you're there for 2 hours, you put the head down and you do your best to, you know, to get that gig done. And then, you know, you could go on, as Ferg said, the next night in the same city and be feeling completely different about it and have the best gig you think you've ever played. But the crowd may go home, you know, not feeling that way. And we've seen, you know, we've had reviews over the years that, you know, you go, over there at the same gig we were, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So you kind of just go with your own gut. And it's funny how, as Ferg said, the four of us we'd be in the dressing room afterwards, and without kind of anyone having to say anything, we'd look at each other and go, yeah, it was one of those ones, wasn't it? You know, it just, we can all feel it on the stage. And that few hours becomes very long when you're doing it. You look at the set list and you think, we've still got so long to do. Why am I not kind of feeling this? And it is, it's, there's so many kind of things that can happen. And it could be just, you know, you could be tired. The crowd may not be great. I mean, the sound could be off. There's 101 things that can happen. You know, it's part of it. And when you're starting out, it's devastating because you think, that's me finished. That's my career over. You know, one bad gig and no one's going to remember the other 1,000 I did that were great. So you just kind of learn as you get older with it and you're more experienced. It's just one of those gigs and you just, you know, it, tomorrow will be another day and you'll get up there again and do it. And you do, you always come back to it. I mean, it just, it calls you back no matter how long you're away from it. Eventually you think, yeah, be good now, you know, and then that's just kind of, that's why we've done it, I guess, for as long as we have.
So, but I know that you found one another when you were just kids. So do you remember that first time that each of you performed as a band? Like talking about starting out, I mean, you know, thinking about that first ever concert, do you remember that moment or where it was or what happened?
Yeah, unfortunately.
Yeah. I want to relive all of your nightmares, please.
The Flag Cafe, Farag, remember?
Yeah, Flag Cafe. What about 12 people there, if even.
Yeah.
12's not we bad, pretty... look. 12's not bad.
Yeah, yeah. And we made, I think there was one song we made a mistake in. And then Mike, we still to this day, the bass player, we were standing outside waiting to be picked up afterwards. And Mike says, oh, we're finishing this town anyway, lads. I'll always remember.
Like we're done
for. We'll never play this town again. Or
yeah, that's it. Like,
yeah, that was
never
it.
Never playing this town again.
Yeah, I mean, so it's just a perfect example of how it just, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was it. We're done. but that was the first gig. It was a tiny little cafe in town. But yeah, everyone's got to start somewhere. And it's funny, like that's a long time ago. And I think both Farag and I can remember it like it was yesterday.
Yeah.
You do remember
those
first gigs. You know, no matter, you probably remember those sometimes better than, you know, the big shows you go on to do later on.
Well, I suppose they were so monumental in just in your growth, not only as an artist, but also as a human. It's like one of those massive milestones that when you're younger and you're starting out, I mean, I don't think I've ever spoken to anybody who said that first concert was the best thing I've ever done.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Everyone's like, I'm so embarrassed to tell you it was like a choir or, you know, in a parking lot.
Yeah.
But that's kind of, it's kind of wonderful to see and trace the trajectory, like how you didn't even probably realize it at the time and you were just getting better and better by proxy of not only trusting yourselves, but also experience, just literally honing that craft. Do you feel like it's one or the other? Like, has something contributed to you getting better or more comfortable on stage?
Yeah, I think the more you do it, you know, the experience of playing live and getting up and doing it every day, that definitely made us tighter as a band and just gave us confidence, I think. And, you know, it helped with everything because then it helps recording because you're playing really well together as a unit, and then you go into record and it just goes smoothly and everything goes really fast.
Was there a moment on stage or during a tour at some point in the early days when you turned to each other and you said, instead of saying, we're done for, we'll never play in this town again, you thought like, oh, there's actually something here. Like when, what was that? Was it a show or a studio session or validation from fans? Like how, what was that click moment?
The first gig we did, we had toured in Europe and the album, the first album, hadn't done anything. And we were the opening act for another band, another Irish band, I should say, the Hot House Flowers. and kind of people weren't really taking any notice of us, and we were kind of, you know, we were on when the doors were open and you did your half an hour and then that was it. And it was kind of, you felt a bit defeated by it. But then we got this call to come to America, and we, first place we went was Denver, Colorado. We were the opening act for Dede, and we arrived in kind of a bit oblivious to the success that had Linger had already kind of taken off, but we kind of weren't aware of how big it had become. And that first night we went out to play, and again we went out to do our half hour set or whatever, and the place just went insane. They knew all the lyrics to the songs, and it was like the complete opposite of some of what we had been doing a week earlier. And I think for me anyway, it was one of the first nights I kind of thought, hold on a minute, you know, we must be doing something right here, because that's a kind of a turning moment for us, in that it went from strength to strength from that point on. Like after that first show, it's one of those shows that it went by in a flash, because you were kind of so blown away by the reaction from the audience. And we were, you know, we'd been to America once to do the video for Linger. We weren't aware. Yeah, we'd never been there before, you know, since that point. And then suddenly we walked out and like played whatever the first song was, and the place just erupted, and that continued on. And you're suddenly going, hold on, you know, we're on the other side of the world for us, and everyone knows our songs and really seems to like it too. And that was that was one of the best feelings, I think. And, you know, by the time we came home a few months later back to Ireland, we were greeted, you know, that the airport was full of press and all this kind of thing and big hullabaloo, because suddenly we were the band that left. We left to go to Europe with the other band, and then flew from Europe out to the States, and then came back kind of, you know, suddenly the album was doing really well. And, you know, you kind of felt finally people were starting to get what we do.
Isn't that amazing, though? Just to like go, as you said, like that it's such a visual memory, just knowing that the one week you're sitting doing something and the following week you just like have people singing back your, you know, the songs that you've written. And even like, I feel like with especially the Cranberries, a lot of people would like sing the non-verbal parts, like the musical parts. I don't know. It's like, maybe it's just like my crowd of friends. Like we've just always sang like the guitar parts and you know what
air
I mean?
Guitar.
And air guitar and, you know, the drum, the percussion parts. And I feel like you allow the audience to be so involved, because it, you know, you really were so beloved right from the beginning. And then, okay, so then you saw all these people singing back. Did that give you any sort of sense of like how big you'd actually be, or was it landing at the airport in your hometown when you were like, this is my life now?
Yeah. That was weird when we got back, because we left and nobody knew who we were. We were just normal, you know, some guys in a band in Limerick, no big deal. And then when we got back, it was very strange, because there was people, you'd be walking on the street and people pointing, going, there's your man from the Cranberries or whatever. Was strange to kind of get your head around. But that kind of lasted only for a few years, and then it kind of calmed down again. And we could, you know, go about our business in Ireland and no one would pay any attention. It was fine, which has made it really comfortable. Because, you know, when you're on tour, you expect that kind of attention. Because, you know, you're playing in town, there's posters up and it's like, oh, there's your one from the band, or there's Dolores, there's Noel, you know. And then you come back home, you want to get away from that. You want to just be a normal person and switch off from all that. So that worked out kind of really well in the end. Because we weren't really that popular in Ireland towards the end.
Well, I think maybe people just felt like they didn't want to bother you. It always happens with, like, you know, you have respect, I suppose. If you know that the person's just wanting to live their life, it's kind of, I feel like, how do you both deal with that fame and celebrity aspect of what you do? Like, do you disconnect from it? Can you see it as part of you? Because obviously, the number one is the music, right? But
yeah,
even you mentioned Dolores, like just her image, just her face, all of your faces together on a poster, it's like, you know, people really responded. And I suppose then you get thrust into this weird, like, fame bubble. So how did you disconnect to make sure that you weren't, I don't know, letting it not go to your head, but just let it ruin your life, you know? Because the privacy thing, I suppose, is really tough.
Yeah, like, we, the three boys in the band, we tended to go do it and then come back here to Limerick and kind of disappear and live our life. Like, we all, you know, we hung around with the same people that we grew up with. We kept that same gang, and we'd go out with them, and they didn't really care what we did. But it was a lot harder for Dolores because she's the fun person. She was quite outspoken.
Yes.
She was the female in this group of boys. And so for her, it was definitely harder when it hit. And Ireland's a small country with not a lot of what you would consider celebrities here. So they hounded her, like, straight away. And she kind of, she met the guy who became her husband then, and she ended up kind of moving to Canada for a while to get away from it. And she even there lived outside of the city, away from it. And, you know, you do, you try and find a kind of happy place where you can go to what you want to call work. You go off and you do the rock star thing. You
yes.
do the tour and show up at the things you're meant to. But then, you know, it's great to be able to jump on a plane, come back here, and you just do what everyone else does. You know, you do your groceries and you do the school runs and all the normal things. And we kind of, I wouldn't say we fought hard for to do that. It wasn't, you know, kind of like that way. But we always made sure, okay, tour's over, you know, on Wednesday, we were going home Thursday, and that was it.
Yes.
And, you know, we did that the entire time. It was great. Look, we had the success and we were able to go and kind of take time off away from it then and hide away. But it was definitely harder for Dolores through the whole thing. And it's part of it. You don't think of when you start in a band, you just think, I just want to do the music. I want to play the gigs. You know,
sure.
I want to do the thing I really love doing and create this thing.
Mm.
And it, like, it is a big surprise when it hits you the first time, when you, like that, you walk out in an airport and suddenly your photo has been taken by all these people.
Oh my God.
You kind of go, I had never really thought about this side of it. And it's a whole other learning curve that I guess a lot of it depends on who you surround yourself with. If you have the right people with you, like friends and family, they don't really care what you do, so they'll just kind of get on with it like you will. And we've been lucky like that, because I think if you have the wrong people around you, that can go to your head. And you know, we all know the stories. There's been a lot of tragedy in music because of that.
Absolutely. I am so sorry to hear about her passing. I feel like I can't believe it was 2 years ago.
Yeah.
I don't want to bring her up without mentioning it. I feel like we're all human, and I just think it's, you know, what happened, it's just such a tragic story when any loved one leaves, especially just somebody who was so pivotal and vital in both of your lives, everyone's lives that she touched. So, you know, I think that just, it's so wonderful to hear that she, you know, did leave and like had that foresight to do it. But you're so right, she really did have it tough in terms of, because she was so outspoken. How funny to think, like, now how, like, being outspoken is not revered, you know. It's a you know, it's such a tricky, complex thing. Like, why wouldn't you be outspoken?
Of course, if you believe in something,
sure,
it's your opinion, you should be able to express your opinion on it.
Yeah.
But then people say, oh, she's so awkward.
Yeah.
It's like, no, she's not. She's just being honest.
Yeah. I think you're awkward. Yeah. When people say that, it's often their projection, because it's like a type of honesty you've never felt. You know, when you meet somebody who's quote unquote strong and outspoken, you're like, oh, you're faced with a mirror of what you aren't. So I think that's probably, that is what happened with her as well.
Yeah.
But you've all been in that way somehow. You've not ever been one of those bands that don't, you know, that shy away from speaking up about important issues, whether that's in your work, in your music or where else, which I think is something, you know, to really be proud of.
Yeah, like we've just, we were talking about this the other day, that for us, the main things that we just stayed true to ourselves in the music, you know, we didn't kind of go with trends and kind of go, oh, we better say this and do this and play this kind of music. Now, this is what's hip at the moment. You kind of really have to follow, I started this for a reason and I still want to do it for this reason. And genuinely for us, the music was what brought us here and it's what kept us here. And I think when you lose sight of that, you become more obsessed with, I want the fame and I want all the trappings of that. That was something we had no interest in. And that way you kind of just get on with it and you say what you think and you do what you think and you play the albums. You know, you write the songs that you think are right for you at that time. Mm-hmm. And whether people get it or not, that's really their problem. It's not really, you know, we want to be able to look at any of the albums we've done and kind of go, yeah, well, I'm still really proud of that. Whether it be 25 years ago or in 40 years time, you know, from when it was released. Whereas I don't know if every artist does that. Sometimes you can follow these trends, and trends come and go, and then you have to live with what you've done. So you're just got to be true to what you believe. And that's, I think, genuinely what we've always done.
I think now more than ever, especially with what's going on politically and environmentally and in the entertainment sphere, I feel like if you can't tap into that authenticity, it's really hard to stay afloat. You know, do you have a lot of young artists turning to you and asking, like, if you're on the road in the past, do you feel like you've been able to, you know, do people turn to you for some sort of guidance or advice?
Well, some of the younger bands we tour with, we kind of end up, you know, having a few drinks with them and chatting afterwards. But yeah, it's kind of hard to give advice, really, because especially nowadays.
Why? Because everybody's a know-it-all.
I'm joking. Tips for starting off, you know, for bands, like how do we kind of get our leg up? And it's so different from when we started off. There was no internet when we started off, you know.
Oh, my
we
God.
Would post...
There was
We'd
no
post
internet.
Cassette tapes to record companies.
Isn't that amazing, though? You were in like the golden era.
Pause the podcast. It's time to step away from the conversation with the Cranberries ever so briefly to share a special segment. We typically like to share our favorite live show or live stream of the week, but we want to continue putting a spotlight where it's most needed and instead highlight an organization we think you should contribute to. This week, we're highlighting Wisconsin's African American Roundtable, an organization led by and serving the African American community to empower, organize, and transform policies to change the lives of African Americans in Milwaukee. To contribute, head to wisconsinvoices.org/AART. That's wisconsinvoices.org/AART. But for now, back to Lior and the Cranberries. Enjoy!
Remember reading an interview that you did for the reissue of Everybody Else Is Doing It, that you played that massively important gig before you even signed to a label. Like, that really even happens now, you know?
Yeah.
Like, people just put stuff on SoundCloud. Like, who doesn't know that, you know?
Yeah. How, it's like, kind of like YouTube does a lot of the work now that, you know, when we were saying about playing to kind of a room of, you know, 12 people or whatever amount of people. But we did a lot of tours before we were known, especially in the UK, of being the opening act or doing your own show. And, you know, you were playing to kind of nobody and kind of crappy clubs and, you know, and then you'd have a great show with, you know, you'd fill a room. Now it might only be, you know, 100 people or something. But then the following night, you know, you could have an awful show where it was like people were more interested in what was going on at the bar than you. But, I mean, you're learning your craft, you're learning your trade, you're kind of working your way up. And that seems to be all gone now, because I think a lot of particularly record companies, they just, if you don't have, you know, whatever, a million views on YouTube, they won't even bother coming to see you anyway. And it's got to be so difficult for an artist starting out now.
I agree.
Because it's, you know, it was hard enough without the internet and, you know, posting cassettes and trying to get the A&R guy to listen to it. But at least if they listened to it, they'd come back to you and go, look, we will come to a show. And they knew, they didn't know anything else about you. Whereas now, you know, you, with a click of a mouse, they'll know everything about you and they'll make the decision before they ever leave their office. Yeah, you know, I like the look of this or I don't. And they don't have enough listens or views or whatever on, you know, whatever it might be. So I you know, no disrespect to anyone starting out, but I really would dread to be starting from scratch. Now it's got to be so hard.
I agree. Also, just, I mean, I've been doing this for like over a decade now, and just seeing like even just people from last year to this year, the rapidness of the industry. It's like TikTok and, you know, Twitch and all these streaming services and things like that. I feel like they don't get the chance to like mess up. Like make mistakes. Like, can you imagine there was somebody at your at that first show, and you could like Google it and go, and, like it's online already. Like it's on Instagram Live.
Yeah.
And there's 12 idiots just standing there going like, who's this band? What is this?
Yeah.
Like that. You know. Yeah. Can you imagine all your mistakes were documented? I mean, it's
there's
it's...
enough for them there. Yeah. As it is, yeah.
Did you have a lot of those moments? Like, did either of you, like, what kind of, what are the, I don't want to ask you what the horror stories are from bad performances, but I kind of do. No, I don't. Stop me. I would, have you had, did you ever play like a super unusual venue or, I don't know, something weird was thrown at you? Like, what are your war stories from like tour?
There's been a few, all right, I guess.
Don't hold back, you know, though, right?
Well, no, I remember when, do you remember, Berg, when we brought, we have a friend, Jer, we grew up with him. And when we started out, I think it was our first tour of the UK, and we were the opening act for another band. And we, you know, someone said, oh, you got to bring like a kind of a roadie with you to help out. And we asked our friend Jer, who we still hang around with, but Jer knew nothing about music. He never picked up a guitar, a bass. He doesn't know, you know, he listens to music like anyone else. But so, you know, poor Jer kind of lasted of whatever, maybe it was a 3 or 4 week tour. I think he lasted a week and a half and went home, because we were like, I'd break a string and he'd be trying to string up a guitar. He'd never picked up a guitar in his life. And he'd hand me the guitar, be covered in blood, because he would be sticking the the strings into his fingers and cutting them with the pliers, and you know, and the guitar wouldn't be tuned up. It was, you know, and this was the early days before we kind of anyone knew us, and you think, okay, this is a great start, you know, and and it just, there's been so many stories over the years of things that go wrong. I mean, there's a book alone in horror stories of any band, I think. Now, thankfully, you have far more better gigs that go right. It's right. Funny how you remember, again, you remember the ones that kind of went pear-shaped. There, you may not remember where you were, but you remember what happened, you know. So, there can't be a band alive that hasn't, you know, some horror stories from over the years.
Oh, man. So, but you still hang out with Jer. So at least he's still around. Yeah. You didn't throw him out to the...
No, he... Because we were kind of going, I think we need to send him home. And like, before we got to say, he came in one night to the dressing room covered in sweat, said, lads, I'm going home tomorrow. I can't do this anymore. So
bliss.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
But it's a fucking hard job. Like, that's why God. I always focus on, like, trying to give dues to the crews and people working behind the scenes of performances, because the amount that you don't see, it's remarkable. It's like a magic trick.
Yeah. Yeah.
It is.
How big is your touring, how big is the group that usually goes on tour with you? And have most of those people been your techs for a long time?
Yeah, there's about 6 or 7, we'll say.
Yeah.
Hardcore, close members that have been doing it for 20 odd years, you know. And it makes it a lot easier because,
you're familiar with these people, they're friends, they're like family, you know, and we kind of all huddle together when we're going through a hard time, and everyone encourages each other to get through it, you know, and it's amazing to have that.
Yeah, I can imagine it also allows you to be like much more comfortable as well, that you don't have to reintroduce yourself or the way that you work every single time you go out.
And
you need that trust, because you're walking out there in front of whatever amount of people, and like always when someone new might start, and you know, you'll have those first few gigs where you're, you know, you're kind of, your safety net isn't there. If the guy who you've used for a long time, you kind of go, if something goes wrong, I know he's got my back. But eventually, you know, like everyone has that first night where they've got the start. So we've been very lucky that most of the, as Ferg said, like the 5 or 6 main crew stuck by us no matter what. Like, we could take a few years out, give them a call, they're back again, and you feel really comfortable. There's not that getting to know each other, or how, you know, everyone's got their own way of working.
Yes.
And when you find that person that you click with, you don't have to, you know, you show up for sound check, everything's ready to roll, and you walk out to the gig feeling comfortable, because you've enough to be kind of going through in your mind without the worry of, am I going to hit this and bang, straight away it's going to go wrong. And that's why we've always, you know, and it's great because we've all kind of grown up together with this, as in, you know, we would have met each other. We, the four of us, would have been kids. They would have been a bit older. But, you know, between marriages and then kids and, you know, people getting married, like their kids getting married and so on. So it's been amazing to kind of just have that little group, that small family on the road with you.
Did it make everything that shifted and changed? Because obviously, I don't know, like, are you both nostalgic people by nature? Because, you know, I talking about the reissue of No Need to Argue, I feel like it's so exciting, but you're also having to then, I suppose, dig into a life that you are no longer living in now. And but it is still part of you, of course. It's not like an extra random spooky limb like running around, you know, still attached. But how has that been for you to just like work on the box set and know that it's coming out? Because I know your fans are, you know, it's something that like people love a reissue. They love stepping back into things and knowing that it's going to, you know, the archive's coming back and going to be treated in a different way. So how do you both feel about it? Just from a nostalgic sense of you.
Yeah. There's moments where you're, it's difficult because you're, because of Dolores passing, you know,
right,
where you're listening back to things and she's talking maybe between takes and a recording, or chatting to the audience. There was some video footage that we were going through for the Daffodil Lament has a new video that we kind of put up for that, with lyrics and some footage from when we were recording in Oxford. But then you're trying not to get down about it, because you're trying to celebrate the past and celebrate Dolores' life, you know, rather than being miserable about it, you know.
It kind of gives you the opportunity to relive those moments as opposed to just like finding them so hard to go through. But it's always hard. I mean, a passing can never leave you. It's in your system forever, you know. So when you hear her voice between takes, do you remember those moments, or is it one of those happy surprises where you're like, shit, this actually happened? Like, this is fucking great.
No, you kind of remember everything like it was yesterday. It's bizarre.
Wow.
You know, you just remember that time and those feelings. Looking back at those videos, it was like, Christ, I remember. It feels like 2 years ago rather than 20 years ago.
Yeah. Totally, yeah. I was surprised, actually, at how long ago it was, because it looks, you know, you're looking at it going, my God, that could have been, you know, like Ferg said, 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And even before we saw those videos, if you were to just sit down and think about it, it still doesn't feel like 25 or 6 years ago. It's crazy how quickly time goes by like that. But it's lovely to see. And I mean, like, what a great legacy Dolores has left behind her as well, then, to have these songs, you know, will and should, you know, hopefully be here in another 25 years that people can hear them. I mean, no artist can ask for more than that, really.
And you realize that it takes on a different shape when it's given to everyone else. Like, you talk about legacy when it's happening.
Mm.
And then when it is something that's gone and you're revisiting it, it's like how you approach it really means a lot. And I feel like you've all approached it really celebrating everything, mm, as opposed to like hiding away or letting other people do it, you know, which is also fine.
Yeah.
Everyone deals with a passing or a change or a shift in a different way. But I love that you have chosen to, you know, include her as much as possible in a way that doesn't feel like you're tokenizing a person or, you know, it really feels wonderful. I feel like, you know, I don't know. Do you think, like, how would she have thought about all of this? Like, do you feel like, when you watch the videos, did you think like, oh God, she wouldn't want that in there? Like, you think, oh, no, she want that in there? I don't know. Like, isn't that amazing? Like, she, yeah, she'd be so proud.
Yeah, you have to look at it that way.
Exactly, that's it, yeah. I mean, I think she was very proud of everything she did, you know, and the band did. So, and the funny thing was, a lot of the video that it was Stephen Street had the video at home, who produced a lot of our albums. He had sent it to us. And I don't know how long it is. The video is maybe an hour and a bit. 90% of it is us messing, just kind of laughing and joking. And you kind of wonder, how do we get anything done? Because it looks like we haven't. It looks like we've barely worked. It looks like we just spent the whole time joking. And it's lovely, you know, and she loved that. I think that's a side of Dolores a lot of people didn't know, because, you know, you have this kind of public face, but privately, she just loved to joke around all the time. So it's great to, it was a lovely reminder to see that.
And I know fans have loved Yesterday Is Gone since you debuted it on the MTV Unplugged. And so how does it feel to finally release it, like officially release it as well? I mean, that's not the only thing officially being released, but how does it feel to have that kind of, you know, out there?
It's great.
It's cool.
I think that was the only time we played it. We didn't really play it live much in the set or anything like that. And
was there a reason, just because of the setting or the mood? Like, why?
It's just one of those ones that kind of forgotten.
We kind of forgot about it.
I thought the same thing.
I was like, how come we never even recorded it or played it again after MTV? And then it just, yeah, I don't know, it was the 90s. You forget a lot of things, you know. So
it just, when you're working so hard, yeah.
It was crazy that we just literally, we played it that one time and there's never again. Like, we were probably doing a gig the following day. Yeah. And nobody thought to say, should we put that new song in? It just kind of disappeared. So, but it's great because it worked out that we have it now anyway for people that may not have heard it before.
Absolutely. It was almost divine universe came and messed in the plan. But so I also absolutely adore your cover of Close to You, which is included here too. And there's something so special just about a well-chosen cover. I don't know if either of you are like cover geeks in that sense, but is there another cover that was like equally meaningful for you both in your career, or have you heard a band cover you that you loved? Like, how close are you to that concept? Because I think it's such an art form when it's done properly.
I think with a cover version, you kind of have to put your own sound on it, you know, and not do it the exact same as the original artist did it. There's no point to do it the exact same because it's been done one way already and it's perfect that way. So why would you try and replicate that?
Right.
You have to kind of do a different version and try and put your own stamp in it. And it's more respectful, I think, to do it that way.
Yeah, that's a really nice way of putting it, because I suppose if you're just mimicking, it's karaoke, right? Then you're
just re-singing
somebody's words. And
You
are also unique in just the way that you play. If you didn't put your own spin, it would be so strange. I don't know how your fingers or your brain would, like, you know, deal with that if you tried to replicate something, because you have your own style.
Because it can get scary, you know, when you're asked to do these things.
Yeah.
You're kind of a bit, oh, I don't know if we should or shouldn't. You do want to do it, but you worry, you know, a lot of these kind of songs that get covered, they're big songs, they're, you know, they're big shoes to be filling. So you'll either make a complete mess of it or you'll do a great job. There's never a kind of an in-between, I think. So again, it's a case, as Ferg said, you just kind of, you do your take of it and, you know, you play it the way you would play if it was one of your own songs, the best way to do it, and not try and just do a karaoke version. Because I think it gets passed over pretty quickly if you do that.
But I'm sure your stuff has been covered so much. Like, have you seen a lot of people covering it? Or, I mean, probably just type into YouTube and you'll see it.
A lot. I think Zombie and Dreams in particular, both those tracks seem to come up a lot. And mixed results, let's put it that way, you know.
So you're saying they should? No, I'm kidding.
Yeah.
I'm gonna make
mixed,
the headline.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, I'm going to make the headline. Yeah. Cranberries think you're all shit. Yeah.
You know, mixed results, I'll repeat that. Yeah.
But also what's cool about this set is that it also includes some unreleased photos as well, which I think, like, not a lot of people do that. I think they forget that the fans want to see this entire world. And so you've got these unreleased photos and an essay, especially just because of your diehard loyal fans, them getting to see that. Or was it more for you to look back at those moments and be able to release it? Like, what was the intention behind that?
We had worked with Andy Earle. I think he did pretty much most of our photography for the albums. And he did the cover of the last album in the end. And we were talking to him, telling him that this was coming out. And he said, I think I have a load of files of photos from that session. Because we did like a 2-day photo shoot, traveling around Dublin with the couch in the back of a van, setting it up,
God,
in different places.
That's funny.
So he said, I think I have files with loads of those spare photos that we haven't used. So he kind of sent over a load of stuff, and then we went through it and went, oh, we should put on some of these ones that haven't been used before.
So who carried that couch around every time you park the truck wherever? And
yeah, there was a few people helping out as well, but we were kind of, at one point we threw it into a boat and went out to Dalkey Island off the coast of Dublin and took photos on an island and came back in a boat again.
I feel like I can just picture you not on the boat, but on a couch, just sailing across the seas, just floating to nowhere.
Yeah.
But isn't that amazing? What a brilliant idea. That must have been so much fun.
It was great fun.
Ridiculous.
Yeah.
Do you remember, again, talking about the ideals of nostalgia, do you each remember the first concert that you ever saw live? The first band that you ever saw on stage, or the first performance that, maybe not the first one, or the one, you know, just the one that really stuck out to you?
We all went to see U2 when we were like 15, 16.
Oh my God.
They were playing in Cork. So we got the train down, a bunch of us together. And I remember Mike had his ticket safely in his shoe. And then the heat, it was summer, the heat. And he was walking around all day. And then I said, okay, come on, we get our tickets out, so we go in. So he takes off his shoe and his ticket had dissolved in his shoe. And he was nearly crying.
Evaporated.
Nearly crying.
Yeah.
So we all chipped in and bought him another ticket.
Yeah. Oh my God. Wait, when was this? What year?
1987. The Joshua Tree Tour.
Yeah, Joshua Tree Tour.
Oh my God.
August 8th, 1987. I remember the poster up on my wall for years afterwards.
Do you still have that
it was
poster?
It amazing.
Do you still
no,
like,
I don't think
in
so.
A box somewhere? Oh, damn, man.
No, I doubt it.
Please keep the poster. No. or his incinerated ticket. Fuck, that's so funny.
I know, he should have kept and framed
it.
Yeah, his dirty ticket. Oh, man, well, at least you all joined in together in solidarity to help him. Now you wouldn't ever need to worry. I suppose everything's Digital.
He still gets a hard time about that.
Does he?
Yeah.
You should say, where do you keep everything else? Do you always keep stuff in your shit?
Yeah.
Look, yeah. I'm not even going to lie. It's actually not a bad place to keep your shit, because with like when you're walking around big crowds,
except for
paper.
Just not on a hot day when you're going to sweat a lot, you know.
Should have wrapped it in plastic or something.
Yeah.
Oh, sure. Well, you would have definitely had that idea. Mm.
Yeah. Yeah.
They were huge by that time.
It was a 86, stadium.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was like a big homecoming gig, really, for them. It was amazing. We were all kind of, I think, in awe of it, just kind of going, this is an Irish band. And, you know, they were massive in America at the time. That album was obviously, you know, it was so big.
It was so great, yeah.
Yeah, and it was the first proper gig I think we had been to. And you kind of, you know that you feel... when a band comes on and it just the first hit of that drum and it just the air moves through the whole stadium, it's just like, I mean, it's on, you know, you can't really describe it, you have to feel it. And I always remember that as just being kind of, wow, this is just unbelievable. It was the last thing in our minds that someday we'd be up in a place doing something like that, but it definitely was part of, I guess, the journey for us to, you know, to fall more in love with music.
And especially see your, you know, what would become your peers, like see them, and people from your own hometown. Because I know I'm from South Africa and like seeing a South African band like make it big. I'm sure Ireland is the same. The industries are so small. Obviously, you're closer to Europe and UK, so it's easier to tap into that market. But when a band from a small, you know, town makes it at that level, it's like there's no pride, is like not even a good enough word to describe it, I suppose.
Yeah
But were you playing music by that time already, you guys? Were you in?
No, I don't think we'd even started. We haven't even played any instrument at that stage.
Do you think that show made you start playing?
We started thinking about it more seriously, maybe, but we think we thought that could never be us because they're from Dublin. This big band, you know, they're huge. I think when we started seeing smaller bands in Limerick and smaller Irish bands playing in Limerick, then we kind of said, oh, it's more within reach. You know, we kind of realized then that maybe we could do this. Makes it more accessible, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like when you can put yourself in that moment and think that it's really possible. Like it's actually possible because they've done it right in front of you.
Yeah, and like these are guys you would see in the same bars or whatever where we would go out at the time.
Yes.
You think, there's that guy I saw on stage the other night. And it's like you realize these are just normal guys and girls walking around the place that, you know, getting on with their thing as well. And kind of think, sure, why don't we give that a go? You know, we're into music, we loved it. And then you just want to start to create something that you think you would want to hear. I think that's been the thing with us, is that we always kind of said, would we want to hear this kind of music? You know, and that's why we made the music the Cranberries made.
God, can you imagine playing music that you like hated? I don't know. God. just being part of like a machine.
Yeah. Because we've had songs, you know, especially in the early days, with some brutally bad songs. And thankfully, like we'd use them to fill up the set because we had maybe six songs and we'd be the opening act. But you know, we had the wherewithal to go, oh, that's kind of crap, let's get rid of that. And, you know, you wouldn't be looking forward to playing that 3 minutes every night. So, and we were lucky, we had the luxury of being able to do that as time went by. And you do, even songs you loved at one time, you do tire of them a bit.
I was going to ask, because that's natural, right? In any repertoire, any artist's repertoire, you do get it, just because it loses its meaning in a sense, because it's just part of you. Are there songs of your, like on your set list that are often on there that you just like, we cannot play that anymore? Or you just know your body goes into like robot mode when you're playing it?
Yeah. But I think... did we leave Linger out one time, I think,
once.
Ever? And there was murder, like the crowd went mental.
Oh, I'm sure. And,
so I was like kind of, we never do that again. so Linger was a bar, I think, apart from that one gig.
One time.
It was probably in every set. And Linger was our very first song.
Yeah.
So there were nights where you could slightly go on autopilot with it because it, you know, you knew the song so well and kind of, you know, but still the fans have paid to come and see this. This is songs they love, you know, so you just, you know, it's not about us. It's especially the gig. It's the audience that matter. So you kind of, you know, you do it for them.
Yeah, you've almost got to detach from that, like why yeah, you're there yeah. and the reasonings, like the personal ego to it,
exactly.
not in a bad way, but you almost have to go like, yeah. I know that we are so beloved for this. And there's so many bands that don't even have those hits, you know, like, but your hits are so, they are like ingrained in people's brains. Like there's nobody, even if the person hasn't heard it, in years, I can tell you they will be able to sing it back. Like, it's so catchy.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's the time when it came out or what. It's the songwriting, it's the band, it's everything. But they really, yeah, I can imagine you piss some people off if you don't play them.
Yeah.
you're gonna get a riot.
Yeah. It's like when you go and see a band that just decided to play, we're going to just play our new album tonight that may not even be out yet. And it's like, oh God, no, here we go. And 90 minutes of noise of I don't even know one of these songs. Yeah.
This Must Be the Gig is produced by Adam Kibble. We'd like to thank Dean Berger and Daniel Brater for additional music, as well as the Consequence Podcast Network. Hey! If you've listened this far, why not go the extra mile and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you find your podcasts. Your comments provide valuable feedback for us and it helps other people find us too. For information on new episodes, be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram at TMBTGpod and generally just irritate everyone you know about the show. Thanks again, and I miss you already.
Consequence Podcast Network.